Tonight we bring you a 2016 Allworth International Lecture called Turkey and the Syrian Refugee Crisis, presented by Dr. Sigdem Benim, Visiting Professor, Department of Political Science, Boston College.
Thank you very much, Cindy, and thank you very much for inviting me here. It's a great pleasure, actually, to be here, and I hope you're not going to sleep with the lights. If you think you're going to sleep, we can, you know, maybe change the lights. Just give us a shout. And that's my first time in Dulut, and it seems like it's a marvelous place, really. And again, thank you for being here in this nice day. Unfortunately, the topic that we're going to talk about is not the most pleasant as we enter the sixth year of the conflict in Syria that started as a, you know, revolt and evolved to a civil war, then a proxy war between the regional powers. And that is causing a lot of, actually, humanitarian catastrophe in the Middle East. So what I'm going to present you tonight is actually part of a project, hopefully that should be soon published. And I'm going to start, I mean, I have this outline, and we'll talk about first, you know, what is the problem here? Like, especially I'll be telling the story from the perspective of Turkey, and why, actually, why do we need to understand the refugee policy of Turkey? Why does it matter? And is there a difference between Turkish policy before and after? And I argue, actually, that is clearly the case, because Turkey has not been that welcoming to refugees in previous cases. And for the Syrian civil crisis, it has adopted an open-door policy, which basically says it declared from the first day that it's going to accept all the Syrian refugees that need protection. So then I'm going to briefly provide the background of the Arab Spring, and I put this spring obviously in quotation, which, you know, when it first started, it sounded like a spring, but clearly it's not what a lot of the, you know, international observers and academics hope for, and that's probably a better terminology is now Arab revolt, Arab uprisings, and how actually the case in Syria has evolved. Then I'm going to provide some of the data about the extent of the humanitarian crisis in the Syrian case. Then I will move to Turkey's policy. And I will be explaining why it is an interesting case to understand how Turkey reacted to the refugee crisis, and how actually policy of Turkey has changed. And I'm going to argue that it's partly because of two main reasons. One is when the Syrian crisis erupted in 2011, Turkey was actually going through a transformation in its asylum and migration policies that was mostly thanks to EU accession process. I mean, in 1999, Turkey was declared as a candidate country for EU membership, European Union membership. And 2005, it started accession talks, which requires a lot of legislative changes and harmonization of legislation. And migration and asylum policy and border control was one of the issues that needed to be, the legislation had to be transposed from the European Union. And then the second thing, actually, an interesting thing, is that Turkey has been going through an enormous transformation since 2002, when the Justice and Development Party, which still actually is ruling the country, came to power. And its Turkish acronym is AKP, Justice and Development Party, and the party has its roots in an Islamist movement in Turkey, and it has some continuation. So Turkey has gone through a lot of soul-searching and identity kind of challenges, if you like, between secular groups and Islamists, and that is... You know, Islamists had a different kind of agenda and definition of identity for the country that was reflected in its foreign policy. And that overlapped with all these changes in the neighborhood. Then I will question, actually, this whole open-door policy. Is it a sustainable thing? And is actually, you know, Does Turkey still have an open door policy or not? I will explain you if it is the case. And finally, I thought that might be interesting maybe to hear about the most recent Turkey-EU deal about this migrant crisis. You might be hearing in international news how actually EU is flooded by irregular migrants and refugees, and the terminology might be confusing because in total, like actually 1 million people actually has arrived in Europe. Whereas Lebanon, that has a population of 4 million, is already hosting 1 million refugees from Syria on top of several Palestinians. So I will try to explain briefly like what is this Turkey-EU deal is about in migration. So the basic question is that how does Turkey, located in an unstable region with ethnic conflicts, political instability, civil unrest, economic problems, react to refugee influxes, and how does a country's refugee policy transform? So that is kind of the basic question I am interested in answering. And for the Syrian case, there were several, actually, determinants for the change in policy. And Europeanization is one of them. As I said, like Turkey has been furthering accession talks with the European Union. That basically means, bureaucratic and legislative changes. But did it really make Turkey that welcoming? I mean, did it have the defining kind of effect on the policy? I'll argue not necessarily. It had an impact in changing the legal and bureaucratic setting, but the main actually defining factor behind Turkey's decision to open up its borders was about change in self-definition of actors. And I'll go back to this Justice and Development Party and that is currently ruling the country, and the change in its foreign policy. And then finally, I'll actually highlight the foreign policy failure, if you like, that the miscalculation of the Turkish elites. Because when the crisis started, they thought within 3 months or 5 months or 6 months, actually, Assad's regime would topple down, similar to the case in Libya or Egypt. So they were quite optimistic, and they thought, we could host these people. Turkey is prospering, has a good economy, and these friendly people will settle here and then go back in 6 months, and we'll develop, close, friendly ties. But that hasn't been the case. So, and also, to advocate, why we should study refugees and why is it important, actually, to understand the refugee policies of a state. It's clearly a human rights issue, and there's a lot of suffering taking place. So it's a human, probably we should spend enough effort to understand the suffering in the rest of the world. But then refugees, as a political scientist, what is important for us, refugees has a lot of... is actually at the heart of current international system, right? When you talk about the concept of sovereignty, the whole idea of Westphalian nation-state system, refugees are a product of this, right? Delineation of borders, and then, people that need to move between the borders. And, state failure or security, citizenship, they have all links to the notion of refugeehood. And finally, the final two things are the refugee policy reflects the self-definition of a state. Basically, as a state and as a nation, who are you willing to allow in your polity? That tells a lot about the nature of yourself, right? I mean, who do you allow to live with you and who do you not? Then finally, linking protracted refugee situations with regional international security, and especially in the African cases, you see a lot of these protracted refugee situations, which basically means refugees come to another state and they live there longer than 5 years, and they live in a state of limbo. They cannot integrate where they come to. They cannot go back to their home countries. And that can be a major reason of regional instability. That might actually violence clashes just on its own. So these are the reasons, actually, why I was interested in trying to understand Turkish refugee policy. This is a timeline of the Arab Spring, and it all started with actually a Tunisian street seller vendor, just self-immolation of a street vendor in Tunisia in December 2010. And probably, you know, he couldn't have predicted that this would have led to such massive protest in the Arab world, right? And that's, you know, the popular uprisings and protests really spread all around the region. And, you know, the initial optimism actually was reflected in the definition. Like, people started to call it Arab Spring. But now, after 6 years, probably the only country that had some sense of spring is Tunisia, right? There's only a bit of stability and kind of compromise in politics. That is the only case that we see in Tunisia. And the rest of the region is unfortunately worse than where it started. And again, like, you know, the reasons of these revolts are definitely much complicated, and it's not only like just, you know, demand for more democracy, as sometimes, you know, represented in the Western media, but you had severe like unemployment, increasing inflation. So there were several like obviously oppressive regimes led to these uprisings. And you know, quite interestingly and unexpectedly, actually by mid 2012, the regimes that have been ruling several countries for decades have been forced out of power, like the case in Egypt or in Libya. And when the Arab Spring actually arrived to Syria in mid-March 2011, that proved, like, Syrian regime proved to be much more resilient than the case in Egypt or in Libya. And if you move to what has happened in Syria, actually, that started with peaceful protest, but not really peaceful protest, but the kids in a town called Dara writing anti-regime slogans in the houses. And then the regime started to, you know, take those kids, imprison them, torture them, and then the locals kind of had protests. Then the regime kind of oppressed these people violently. That led to actually some of the, you know, previous army people, the army defectors, to form the Free Syrian Army. And then, you know, many civilians also, like, took up arms to join the opposition. Then, but what happened in the Syrian case and made it much more complicated is the actual lack of credible and united opposition. So there were several factions, and partly it's because of the regime that's, you know, revolted, suppressed the opposition. There wasn't much leadership left, actually, to lead this movement. Then, you know, we keep hearing about ISIS, IS, Daesh, you know, whatever you'd like to call it. That has emerged by kind of March 2013. That put another layer of complexity into the Syrian crisis. Then it evolved to a proxy war of regional powers and, you know, mostly kind of a struggle between the Saudis, the Sunni kind of pact, if you like, and versus Iranian involvement for different reasons. And we can talk about this if you're interested in the Q&A. Then, you know, most recently, actually, we had the Russian direct involvement in the crisis, and they have been, you know, bombarding ISIS, and it seems everybody seems to be, like, fighting against the ISIS, but it seems still, you know, at least in the Russian case, we're not totally sure who they're really bombing. I mean, from the Turkish perspective, Turks are claiming that, you know, a lot of the Turkmen forces or other Sunni opposition, Free Syrian Army people, have been actually targeted by the Russian strikes. The most recent thing is actually the UN Security Council adopted a resolution 18 December 2015 that calls for an imminent ceasefire and a political settlement to the crisis. But that doesn't seem to be, you know, taking place, so I would definitely be cautious in, you know, the quick solution of this crisis, at least, let's put it this way. So to give you an idea about the extent of destruction and humanitarian crisis in Syria, I mean, the total population of Syria before the crisis was around 22, 23 million. And, you know, UN estimates that more than 330,000 have been killed so far. And there is 7.6 million IDPs, basically internally displaced people. So these people are actually, you know, displaced from their homes, but they're still living in Syria under dire situations. And 4.8 million people registered as refugees with the UNHCR. So these 4.8 people have been dispersed in the neighboring states. Among them, roughly around 10% lives in refugee camps, and the rest remains in urban settings. And for this year, actually, total appeal of UNHCR was around 4.5 billion for 2016. Until now, only 7% have been covered. So, and to give you a little bit background information, I mean, UNHCR doesn't have a budget on its own to really implement these, like, humanitarian things. They go and appeal the donor states, and they can only act that way. So that is how UNHCR works. So to locate these refugees in the neighborhood, that is a map from Mercy Corps that operates in the region. This is actually from February, and the numbers have changed. So the most recent number is like in the refugees in Turkey is 2.7 million. And then Lebanon hosts around 1 million people. Iraq is hosting a bit less, 245,000 people, and many of them are Kurdish people. Jordan, Egypt, and a little, like a couple of thousand people in Libya are settled, actually. So among these refugees, half of them are women, and 54% are actually below the age 18, so they are children. So when we come to the case and how actually Syrian refugees were, welcomed in Turkey, the first group actually arrived in 29 April 2011. And I think around like 200 people came in, and the Turkish state, as I said, adopted this open door policy. They said, I can, still remember hearing who was at the time foreign minister and who is now prime minister saying that whoever, needs protection from Syria, we're going to open up our borders. Any Syrian can come. And that was a quite striking, actually, statement, for people who have been studying refugee policy of Turkey. And especially if you remember the case in 1991 when, Kurdish Iraqis were fleeing from Saddam, Turkey had an opposite kind of strategy, kind of blocking the refugees in the mountainous area, inviting the international media, and then asking for international solidarity, which led to actually a political kind of solution where they had the no-fly zone that was set up. And this case, it was totally handled differently. So the thing is, Turkey called these Syrians as guests, not refugees, and I'll explain why and what it means. And since October 2011, these people were given temporary protection status, which basically means they are not refugees, because the term refugee in 1951 convention that explains who is a refugee is a very personalized explanation. You should be targeted as being yourself or belonging to a group or having certain, identity and belief. And these people are escaping from generalized violence, so they need temporary protection. That's what is assumed by the Turkish state. And when actually the crisis, as I said in the beginning, when this crisis were taking place in the borders of Turkey itself was going through several transformations. And the first one is the changing refugee regime of Turkey. I want to provide a little bit of background about Turkish history and evolution of its migration and asylum policy. That's not known as much in the U.S., but if you go to Europe and ask about Turkey and Turkish migrants or migration and Turkey, people would probably think about like Turkish migrants in Germany in 1960s. But Turkey has been actually a both immigrant and immigrant country, basically sending people and receiving people and providing a lot of protection to different groups as well. Since actually Ottoman Empire, it's the heir to the Ottoman Empire. And that has provided protection to different groups, like in, I think, 15th century, like the Jews escaping from Spain were settled in Ottoman lands. And, during the actually Balkan Wars, like several million people actually came back to Ottoman Empire. The thing is, Ottoman Empire was an empire, and it had specific migration policies and settlement policies. When you conquer lands, you settle people in those lands, and that creates tax revenues and, you know, agricultural revenues. But when the empire started to run, you know, started to shrink in terms of territory, those migratory moves started to run reverse back to the heart of the empire. And the collapse of the empire left a bitter memory in the minds of the people who created the modern republic. And the Ottoman Empire was a multi-ethnic, multi-religious empire, but as different ethnic groups and different religion groups have started to kind of, under the influence of nationalism, started to fight against, you know, the Ottoman Empire, so the size shrink, and the idea is actually, you know, creating a homogeneous Turkish nation state. And that idea actually defines the immigration policy and citizenship policies of the modern Turkish Republic. So there were basically a settlement law that was written in 1926 and then renewed in 1934 that said that only people that are of Turkish descent could actually migrate and settle in Turkey, which basically means you have to speak Turkish. And in practice, although it's not written, in practice you should be Sunni Muslim. And the authority that was going to decide who is of Turkish descent is actually the Council of Ministers. So, you know, there's a lot of leeway, basically, in deciding on that. And that has actually shaped Turkish immigration policy until recently, until, I would say, you know, Syrian crisis. Turkey doesn't have the experience of integrating non-Turkish people into its society. Okay, although it has its experience of like providing protection to different groups, but in the end they were all resettled somewhere else, or you know, went back to their home countries or countries of origin. The citizenship definition of Turkey, and it will need to come up with original ideas in how to integrate these people. And that's not going to be an easy process. So the legal infrastructure that defines on top of the settlement laws was actually 1951 Convention on the Status of Refugees, which is the basic main instrument that shapes the current international refugees regime. And Turkey was an original signatory to this 1951 Convention and 67 Protocol. The thing is, 1951 Convention was decided with a time limit and geographical limitation. So basically, the idea was actually solving the refugee crisis that was resulted, you know, that originated because of the Second World War. So the time limitation was that the convention would deal with the people before 1951, and the geographical limitation was limited to Europe, right, settling European refugees. The time limitation was actually abolished in 67 Protocol, but the states were given the right to keep, you know, the geographical limitation. And Turkey kept that geographical limitation intact, which basically means in practice, Turkey only gives refugee status to people that come from Europe. So if you're coming from Syria, you would be given still protection, but you wouldn't be called a refugee, but a conditional refugee. Okay? And I'll explain what that means. So until 1994, these international conventions provided the basic infrastructure, legal infrastructure, to deal with refugees. And starting in 1980s, Turkey started to face different migratory movements. And the Gulf crisis and leading Kurdish influx actually forced Turkey to adopt new measures, if you like. In 1994, they adopted a regulation to deal with refugee influxes, and that was a very security-oriented legislative tool. And all the incidents actually were dealt with this tool, legal tool, if you like, until 2013, when Turkey adopted its new foreigners and international protection law. And this law is actually links back to this my idea that, you know, that has a lot to do with European Union integration. That was part of EU legislative, you know, processes. And now Turkey has a much liberal migration policy and perspective. So under the current system, there are three types of protection. The refugee, what is, you know, defined in 1951 Convention, is actually the people who come from Europe. That actually covers part of Caucasia as well. And the second category is actually conditional refugee, people that come from other regions than Europe. And as you can imagine, a lot of the, you know, conflicts take place outside of Europe since, you know, the end of the Cold War. Not really, actually, I mean, probably 1990s. And the way it functions is that Turkey provides protection, for instance, Afghanis or Iranians that escape from violence or persecution. But then it works with UNHCR, and they send this application for asylum, and UNHCR processes them, and if finds them founded, then it helps them to resettle another country, right? That way, actually, Turkey shares the burden, especially economic burden of these people, you know, but also provides the protection. And then finally, it is the type of protection is called secondary protection, which basically means the people that do not fit into these first two categories, but they cannot return back to their home either, especially because of generalized violence or, you know, other issues. And Syrians definitely fit into this category. So as I also said, you know, when all this crisis was taking place, Turkey was going through enormous transformation both in its domestic politics and in its foreign policy because of a new actor called the Justice and Development Party, the AKP. And this actually, this party, as I said, has its roots in a political Islamist group in Turkey that emerged in the 1970s. And they are kind of an offshoot of this political Islamist movement. And they had, you know, much more open and liberal interpretation, yet they still kept a lot of these, like, Islamist assumptions, especially when it comes to foreign policy, that was much more obvious. The way current prime minister actually has been, Ahmet Davutoğlu, has been very critical in defining new Turkish foreign policy. And he's a professor of international relations, and he has really, like, concrete ideas about what Turkey should do and how it should behave in international stage. There's a lot of, actually, like, you know, aspirations to old, good old days where Ottoman Empire was respected and would provide protection to all the Muslims in the rest of the world. There was a lot of idealism in it, but also good dose of liberal, discourse. So he designed this, like, center stage Turkey. Turkey shouldn't be at the periphery of Western bloc, but it is a center on its own, you know, at the intersection of several regions, and it should be much more active and self-confident as opposed to Kemalist or secularist groups' perspective, as they would see it. And Syria was a pet project in some ways, testing the limits of soft power of Turkey, basically. When Bashar Assad came to power, there were optimism that he would actually open up Syria, and, you know, people thought Turkey, with its current elites, could have an influence and say on the transition, peaceful transition of Syria, but that didn't happen to be the case. And in March, you know, up until actually Arab Spring, Turkish foreign policy had performed quite well. It adopted a lot of regional integration policies that it had learned in European context, copycat that, and tried to transpose to the Middle East. Basically, you know, the motto was actually making borders irrelevant, right? That's quite an ambitious goal, but that was becoming the case. Turkey had a lot of visa liberalization agreements with its neighbors, increased its trade tremendously. You know, another big statement was actually zero problems with neighbors. And that liberal world functioned quite well until the Arab Springs. And that Arab, you know, the revolts in the Arab Springs actually put Turkey quite under stress. And that also pushed itself to discover the limitations of its power and its capacity as well. That's another thing. When the Arab Springs started, apparently the people that spoke Arabic in Turkish foreign ministry was around 2%. So it's not that easy to change the direction of a state when you don't have necessarily enough institutional capabilities. And Middle East was a particular kind of focus for the ruling elite at the time. So coming to the actually the open door policy, and you know, questioning how sustainable it is, let's have a look at some of these numbers. Like the total number of Syrian refugees in Turkey is 2.7 million, but you have several other groups of refugees, and when you add up those people as well, it adds up to 3.1 million, which makes actually Turkey the number one country that is hosting the biggest number of refugees in the world. And that is quite a dramatic change within a couple of years. And that wasn't necessarily the expectation of the Turkish state or the institutions. Hence, I'm not totally sure how they are prepared either. So the number of the camp refugees is around 260,000. The initial policy of Turkish state is actually thinking that it is actually a temporary thing. They set up a temporary solution, right? You set up new camps along the borders, and they, you know, people come in, they set up camps very quickly and very efficiently. And I'm going to just show you this nice camp, actually. And this is from New York Times, sometime in 2014. They had this nice article, how to set up a perfect refugee camp. And they're talking about the camps in Turkey. So Turkey received a lot of praise, obviously, for setting up a really high threshold for refugee camps, which sounds really nice, but then that was also criticized for actually wasting its resources, right? I mean, do you really need flat screens in refugee camps? Or can you use that money in a better way? That was also disputed. But in any case, Turkey had the institutional kind of capacity to deal with such a crisis and built these really nicely structured camps and operate them in a really efficient way. And in the Turkish case, it's not UNHCR who runs these camps, and in a lot of the cases, it is running the camps, but it is the Turkish state authority, which is called Prime Ministry Emergency and Disaster Ministry or something like that. So basically, that institution had a lot of experience as a result of earthquakes, and they had this idea of building camps and experience. So that was an efficient initial solution, but once the Turkish state figured out, this crisis is not going to end up in 3 months or even 6 months, and they set up this, psychological threshold as 100,000 people. When we reach 100,000 people, we need to do something. But they quickly reached 100,000 people, and, you couldn't do anything. Then they shift their policy by summer 2012, into a more restrictive policy and, not setting up any more, basically, camps. And the major issue, and I'll talk more about that, is urban refugees. So now, among the 3.7 million people, almost 90% live in urban setting, right? And they have, as a result of temporary protection, they have access to healthcare system, and Turkey has some sort of universal health coverage. And it's been doing okay, actually. And they have access, theoretically, they have access to education. But that is a much more complicated case because the Syrians speak Arabic, whereas the language of teaching in Turkish schools is Turkish, you might expect, right? So it's not that easy, and there's a lot of kind of confusion between institutions as well. As I said, it's been going through this institutional transformation, setting up a new board that will regulate migration policy. Then, Turkey has this also bureaucratic functioning, if you like. It's an established bureaucracy, and it takes a lot of time actually to change something in the system, and that takes time sometimes between communicating, between the ministries, and that might take time basically to solve some of the problems. And again, another interesting thing is actually when the crisis first erupted, Turkey didn't ask for international help, right? In 2012, UNHCR had a regional planning to actually help these countries in the neighborhood. And Turkey said, no, I don't need that. And that would reflect and partly explains my previous arguments. One, there was the expectation that crisis would be resolved pretty quickly and Turkey could cope, because it's a big central country, and you know, with its kind of you know, responsibility towards its hinterland, if you like, its brothers and sisters in the neighborhood. But then, like, since 2012 summer, as it became clear that the crisis will not be resolved that quickly, Turkish policy has shifted as well. And there's much more increasing, you know, emphasis and burden sharing in international society. And actually, there has been the argument of setting up a no-fly zone in Syria, which seems like, you know, not really welcomed by especially American administration for different reasons. So to give you an idea about the camps, it's a quite expensive business. And, you know, 10,000 people person camp apparently costs $10 million and takes a month to build. And aid costs between 200 to 300 per month per refugee. And this is a photo from a camp in the very south of Turkey in a town called Kilis. And the expenditures apparently is like around 2 million a month to sustain this camp, right? And there have been interesting like initiatives, basically, rather than, you know, people providing like hot food to people in the camp, basically there have been initiatives to give these people something like credit cards so they could go and buy their food from the designated shops. And, you know, that is, seems it's working quite efficiently. That reduced actually the cost of food almost one-fourth. Again, you know, the camps are much more organized, has a great infrastructure compared to the cases in, you know, Jordan. Lebanon doesn't actually allow setting up camps. So you have camps in Jordan, and they're not necessarily the best. And again, compared to those ones, the ones in Turkey are definitely like five-star hotels. You know, that has education facility, like, you know, playgrounds and several other things. So the most critical and vulnerable group is definitely the urban refugees, that these people are spread all around the southern belt of Turkey, that are closer to Syrian border, and also bigger towns of the country. You know, initially there was a big challenge of registering these people, right? I mean, why registration matters? Because if you don't register those people, then you cannot access them. They cannot get information. They cannot have an access to the healthcare, nor they can register their kids to the schools or anything. So registration was fundamental. Now it's achieved. Like, Turkey is kind of knows who is who and has some good numbers. But sudden influx of, obviously, refugees into the southern part of Turkey created a change in local economies. And, you know, that creates tensions in the society as well. For instance, you know, the rent prices have apparently rocketed in certain towns. And, you know, the locals are not necessarily happy about that. If you're a doctor that needs to serve in that town and you were paying, I don't know, $200 for your rent, now you have to pay $500, but your salary stays the same just because there's more demand. People are not necessarily happy about that. There is also much more burden on the healthcare system. Like, you know, people go to doctors, and if they were working like waiting 15 minutes, now they may have to wait for like 2 hours to see a doctor. And that creates resentment in local population. The biggest challenge, again, is education of the Syrian youth. And, you know, that is a much complicated issue. Turkey has a centralized education system. And bypassing that system, recognition of schools and diplomas, these are really technical things that need to be solved, but up to now, apparently, only like 10% of the kids have access to schools. And again, that's a lot of financial cost and burden. And whose responsibility is it, you know, to bear all these costs? That's another issue. I had this photos, like, and there is actually very interesting solutions taking place as we speak, you know, and that is actually a part of Istanbul that has gone through urban renewal project. And the current, actually, government is very much integrated to neoliberal economy and have been doing a lot of urban renovation projects. And that is a place where Roma people used to settle, so that wasn't necessarily the most popular part of Istanbul. Now they take away those people and renovated the houses, build up really like expensive houses, but they couldn't sell those houses. And it seems now the Syrian refugees are living, you know, renting actually beds in those places and finding really interesting solutions. And then a lot of these open spaces have become the home for these Syrian refugees, like in the parks and gardens and everywhere. And that is actually creating, obviously, resentment among Turkish population, as they're not necessarily used to seeing, you know, I mean, they're used to seeing some sort of poverty, but not to that extent, I should say. So economic, social, and political impact of refugees, and there's different numbers, but Turkish government states that it has spent so far somewhere around $7.6 billion to $8, even $9 billion. And it's, of course, it's complicated how you really calculate the spending, but, you know, camps is the biggest expense, then healthcare expenses and education and other things. As I said, burden on healthcare system is still quite high. And I already mentioned, like, increased cost of living for locals. And there's also another, like, interesting social dimension that is taking place. There's increased, apparently, polygamy in the southern part of Turkey. And polygamy is not allowed in Turkey, if you ever wonder. And, but, you know, poverty pushes people to find, actually, solutions. And, you know, you see rise of human trafficking, especially on the western coast of Turkey. That's actually, you know, people charge apparently somewhere around 1,000 euros to 3,000 euros to smuggle people to Greece so that they could go to European Union countries. And, you know, also there is security challenges, direct and indirect. Direct security challenges is partly because actually the divisions in Syria has repercussions or, like, you know, mirror images in Turkish side, right? You have an Alevi elite ruling majority Sunni population in Syria, and is Alevi minority in Turkey a mostly Sunni state, or especially with the current government that is perceived as Sunnified state, if you like, okay? So it is creating its own dynamics. And then you have a Kurdish population in Syria, and Turkey has its own insecurity and problems in Turkey with its own Kurds, and that is causing a lot of tension and insecurity. You know, and probably the biggest challenge ahead of Turkey is the concept of integration. So the Turkish state has seen this issue as a, you know, temporary thing. You know, these people are going to go back. They're not going to stay here. But now we're into the sixth year of crisis, and, you know, it would be, I think, too optimistic to expect that these people will go back anytime soon. So Turkish state needs to think about, you know, ways of integrating these people. I mean, they are integrating, some argue, because one way or another, you need to learn the language of the country to survive, right? They're learning Turkish, and there's some sort of exchange and interaction between the locals, and they develop, actually, new economies. Like, in the southern belt of Turkey, now you have Syrian neighborhoods, you have different restaurants, bakeries, and that is a new thing for a country like Turkey that was built on a homogenizing nation-state mindset, right? I mean, after the collapse of the empire, the whole idea was actually setting up a Turkish state that is mostly, like, you know, Turkish descent ethnically and Sunni Muslim. So that is going to be a big challenge for Turkey to really transform. And finally, actually, the public opinion is not necessarily very supportive of the government policies. You know, 66% of Turkish people disapprove government Syria policy, its foreign policy, its active engagement in Syria, and even conflict. Turkish majority of the Turks do not approve that. And we see now the changes in the policy. 67% of Turkish people do not approve government's immigration policies. So people are not necessarily, there's not much open tensions, but people don't necessarily support the idea of hosting that much of refugees or becoming number one refugee hosting in the world. 86% of Turkish people want no more Syrian refugees to be admitted. That's quite a high number, as you can see. And majority of Turks see Syrian case is a humanitarian issue, yet 67% of them are highly worried about potential problem that it might pose. And finally, of course, like if you want to allow these people to integrate or have a decent life, especially the people living in urban setting, they need to have access to labor force, right? Up until recently, they were not allowed to work. So imagine yourself stranded in a, you know, big town like Istanbul, and you're not allowed to work. And for 6 years, you might have come up with some savings, but that wouldn't, you know, survive up to 6 years. So people have been now working in Turkey in, you know, black markets economy, and there's a lot of exploitation, obviously. They are being paid much less than Turkish labor. Then Turkish people also, like especially in the southern parts, you know, any of these immigration discussions, now you can see them in Turkey, and people saying like, oh, these people are coming and stealing our jobs, right? All this, these discussions that you would have seen, for instance, in Europe are now being replicated in the Turkish context. Only 5% of the people actually approve granting permanent work permits to refugees. And at this point, you know, legally, they have no rights or no opportunity to become ever Turkish citizens. That's another thing, like, you know, will they be ever Turkish citizens? And that's a totally new discussion, and that might create a lot of tension as well. That's a similar, actually, chart from another research. I want to quickly move to the Turkey-EU refugee deal and what it's about. In 2015, you know, although there has been a lot of discussion in the European context, oh, these migrants are coming after the Arab Spring, you know, there is flux of refugees. When you look at the numbers in 2011, 2012, the number of actual refugees or immigrants have not increased really. I mean, the routes has changed maybe, but the numbers have stayed same until 2014 and 2015. And that is clearly because of the, you know, worsening situation in Syria. A lot of the Syrians now feeling, you know, that there's not going to be any time solution, so they feel like, you know, they need to reach Europe and find a new solution for their lives. And the European Union has been developing this policy of externalization. It's border control, basically, signing readmission agreements in its neighborhood. And Turkey has been in the radar, and, you know, it has been asked to sign a readmission agreement, which basically means the country to accept whoever passes through its territory and enters the European Union to be sent back and admitted. I mean, according to international law, clearly you are in an obligation to receive back your own citizens. But does Turkish state has the responsibility to, for instance, get back Afghanis or Iranians or Somali refugees? You know, that's another case. And this readmission agreement tells Turkish state to take whoever comes to Europe to go back to Turkey and apply asylum there, okay? Because Turkey would be deemed as a safe third country. So basically they say, you could have applied to asylum in Turkey and provided protection. You don't need to come to Greece. And there's a lot of discussion, obviously, and dispute in, you know, international humanitarian circles. Is it really in line with the existing refugee regime? And it's clearly not. So Turkey signed this readmission agreement for some reason that I couldn't still figure out, and put it into practice, well, actually ratified it in 2014 and asked for a 3-year transition period. So it agreed to take back all the migrants in 2017. And the recent deal is actually about convincing Turkey to pull that date earlier into 2016. And in return, actually, European states agreed that, you know, they would provide roughly 3 billion euros to help the refugees, and then another 3 billion euros that was negotiated in the last round of negotiations in 2018. So starting from 20th of March 2016, irregular migrants arriving in Greece via Turkey will be returned back to Turkey. And in return, actually, for every Syrian sent back from Greece, European Union will admit a Syrian refugee from Turkey. So, and there is again a lot of dispute. Is this really legal? Can you barter or trade refugees? And what does it mean really? Like, I mean, how will that, from a Turkish perspective, how will it help Turkey? Will it really help? Is it really like doable? You know, that's again another big discussion. And there's the problem is not necessarily on the Turkish side. I would say it is on the European Union side. And to put it into context, like the EU has been trying to develop a common readmission program, and in total for the 28 EU member states, they said like we're gonna, you know, resettle 160,000 people, and they haven't been able to do that. So, you know, maybe like in total, I'm not sure about the numbers, like, but, you know, maybe 10,000 or so, you know, that they have resettled. So will that work? I am not very optimistic. And we're going to be seeing a lot of probably suffering that is continuing. And I mean, I cannot expect human smuggling to end as a result of this agreement. So to finalize my words, actually, open door policy of Turkey, how sustainable? At this point, we see that open door policy is not anymore in practice, because in the last round of violence, where actually Russians were bombarding Aleppo, there was again a sudden influx of civilians towards Turkey, and Turkey said, like, no, I'm not going to let anybody in. You know, this is enough. I have reached the limitations of my capacity, and what is permitted is that if you have a valid passport, you can still enter through the Turkish borders. But if you don't have a passport, then, you know, they say we're going to set up camps, but we don't know when. So you'll have to wait on the other side of the border. So in a way, the policy is actually setting up a de facto kind of secure belts on the Syrian side. Okay? And that has its own risk and complications. So one thing, maybe the Turkish state, and I'm not totally sure, that when they signed this readmission agreement with the EU, they might have the idea of actually liquidating the camps that they have set up, because one refugee will be sent back from Turkey, and maybe that's how they want to get rid of the camp, the people that have settled in the camps that way, by sending to Europe, and the urban refugees would be maybe allowed to integrate better on their own. And, you know, the Turkish economy is not really performing that great as it used to. I mean, in 2003, 2004, the GDP increase was around like 7%. Now it's like 2, 3%, I think. And it has its own economic issues, obviously, surrounded with a lot of clashes and conflicts in its neighborhoods. You cannot do much trade, and you had the economic crisis in Europe. So Turkish economy is going through its own like difficult times, which makes it more difficult for the government to convince people to help refugees, I guess. And again, Turkey has a lot of insecurity in its borders, especially the conflict with the PKK, the Kurdish group, and ISIS, actually, you know, most recently operating in Turkish borders. I don't think it's going to be helpful in resolving the refugee crisis. On that note, I'd like to finish my talk, and I'd be happy to answer your questions. Thank you. So what I understand you're asking, Russia is not taking refugees, and if Russia is willing to cause more disturbances in the neighborhood. So Russian policy has its own geostrategic calculations, and Russia has its naval and military base in Syria. That is its own opening to Mediterranean Sea, and they wouldn't let it go that easily, clearly. That has become much more visible with Syrian conflict. One thing about Russia is actually, most recently, one of the NATO commanders were giving a talk and saying that Russia is actually weaponizing refugees. And Europeans were, like, horrified. I was in a meeting, you know, and they said, like, what, are they giving, like, weapons to refugees? No, it's actually what they're trying to say is Russia is using the refugees as a weapon towards Europe. Because seeing all these European Union states paralyzed and paranoid about migration, they really want to trigger more, actually, influx of refugees towards Europe. And they see it as a good way, really, to paralyze the whole system. Are any refugees going to Russia? Not that I know. Because I mean, why should refugees go to Russia? Like, so what you have is actually, let me show you. Can you see that? So this is how actually now Syria is kind of divided. And you have, you know, on the left, this green area is actually controlled by the regime, the Assad forces. Then you have the red ones, the Kurdish areas. Then the, you know, kind of orangey ones are the Islamic State. So I don't think, you know, Syrians are going to Russia to seek asylum. I mean, Russia is trying to provide kind of protection to this green area where it's controlled by Assad. So, and the rest is, I don't think, doesn't have very positive feelings towards Russian when they're bombarding their towns. Yeah, so the question is the the question is of the interplay between Sunni and Shia sectarianism and the country's interest in the conflict. I had to summarize it for radio recordings. So, I mean, what it seems like, definitely Saudi Arabia, as you clearly mentioned, I mean, they're not necessarily happy with the, you know, revolts or, like, you know, popular uprising demanding more rights. And for obvious reasons, I mean, the, you know, Saudi is a kingdom and not necessarily, let me not go that much detail, but, you know, and they have a certain definition and understanding of Islam. And at this point, it seems their biggest fear is actually Iran, which represents the Shia understanding of Islam. And Iran had a big stake in Syria because it is a route for Lebanon and, you know, the Hezbollah, the Shia militias in Lebanon. So they don't want to lose that ally. And also Syria actually helped Iran during Iran-Iraq war. You know, so they had that kind of connection with Assad family and the regime. So they're kind of paying back in some ways. But there's clearly a very strategic interest in Syria by the Iranian regime to reach to Lebanon and the operating of Hezbollah. So Hezbollah is actually now fighting side by side with Assad forces against, you know, ISIS and the other, like, groups, which is an interesting thing, you know. Then you have Russian forces, you know, working together with Assad regime and the Iranians. And then you have the Saudis actually providing funding and potentially weapons, you know, in coordination with American, you know, foreign policy to certain groups to continue fighting against the Assad regime, right? So the problem is that when you have so much regional powers involved in such a conflict, the conflict clearly, you know, goes on and on and on, you know, and you cannot find a solution. And then, you know, the original actually, you know, reasons of uprising gets forgotten and lost in some ways. Thank you. Well, will the Kurds want a separate state in Turkey? I mean, I have to ask which Kurds. So that is a difficult thing. Like, the PKK claims to represent all the Kurds, but actually in the southeast, if you see the election results, AKP, or the Justice and Development Party, is the party that received most of the votes. So that tells us something, that not all the Kurds actually are pro-PKK. And they have good reasons, like, you know, especially in the last several months, you know, PKK has decided to move its actually operations from the, you know, rural or like mountainous area to the city centers. And that paralyzed, you know, the civilians' lives, and that is causing a lot of dramatic things in the southeast of Turkey. So the PKK officially declared, after its leader actually was captured in 1999, that they're not anymore defending an independent state. But of course, do you take it, do you believe in it or not? That's another story. And what is happening in Syria, you know, the Kurds actually, once this whole crisis erupted, the Kurds in these red zones, they declared autonomy, right? And Turkish state has been saying, I don't accept that. You know, you cannot use this, you know, situation and have a fait accompli, and then you say, like, oh, I have my autonomous region. And they say, like, are you fighting, you know, against Assad, or, like, which side are you? Like, locate yourself. And that's, again, another major, actually, problem nowadays between Turkey and the U.S. You know, PKK fighting on Turkish territory, mostly at least, is recognized as a terrorist state both by Turkey, European Union, and the U.S. Whereas it has its, you know, for so many years, actually Syria hosted the PKK, and its leader was actually based in Syria until 1998, when Turkey said, like, I'm going to take it as a, you know, casus belli. It's a reason for war if you keep supporting PKK. And only after that, you know, he had to flee to, you know, different countries, and then he was captured. So PKK has this, you know, sister, brother, whatever group on the other side of the Syrian border. And the whole situation clearly created an opportunity, obviously, for aspiring Kurds maybe to set up their country, you know, an independent Kurdistan. But the Kurds in Turkey are really, do they really want that? I am not totally sure.
Tonight's program was brought to you by the Allworth Institute for International Studies at the University of Minnesota Duluth and by KUMD Duluth Public Radio. This program was produced by Isaac Herman, Maya Jensen, and Cindy Christian. Tune in again 2 weeks from tonight for another Allworth International Lecture. This lecture series is recorded Wednesday evenings at UMD and is free and open to the public.